Hey everybody, welcome to episode 81 of Fit Friends Happy Hour. In this episode, Katie and I interview Becca McConville. Becca is a registered dietitian who is a board-certified sports specialist. We talk about how athletes can eat more intuitively. We also talk to Becca about the other factors that the foods we eat play in our body besides just what we look like and how much we weigh. Becca believes that we can each find a place where our body image, relationship with food, and sports performance can all mutually exist and thrive. All right, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Fit Friends Happy Hour with your hosts, Katie Hake and Lauren Wrighton.
Hi, Becca. It's so great to have you on the podcast.
Hi, this is kind of exciting to be on the other side as a fellow podcaster.
Yeah, and tell our listeners what your podcast name is.
So it's called Fit for a Queen. And so it's a play on words devoted to female athletes trying to balance performance, health, intellect, and time for self.
Perfect. And that's what we're going to be talking about today is athletes and how an athlete can eat more intuitively.
Exactly, yes.
I am super excited about this topic because as a dietitian and having a non-diet approach is challenging in these special populations like athletes. I work in bariatrics, and that's another kind of very targeted, very disciplined area, or so so the standard seems. And so it'll be interesting to hear your approach of kind of, you know, that's not the norm for most athletes, I'm sure. So this will be pretty unique.
So tell us about your background as an athlete.
Sure. So I'm 5'4", so it's funny when I tell people that I actually played basketball in college. See, we're bad about stereotyping how we look at people and what sports they do, right? And actually ended up with a fractured rib that wasn't healing right. And so they wanted me to take a break from contact for a while. And my sweet mates were cross-country runners. So then I actually started running with them, and lo and behold, it's like, oh, I actually like this. I used to dread it. So as I phased out from basketball, picked up running and have done 3 marathons, quite a bit of halves. And then now it's fun as a mom. I actually go and do 5Ks with my daughter. So it's fun that we can do that together and then seeing her across the finish line. So it's kind of funny how you go full circle. I also coach her team, which, I'll tell you what, it's humbling being on the other side now being a coach. I feel sorry for some of the things that I did as a player. I really wish I would have done that back then. I would have been a whole lot more respectful and not so snot-nosed.
How old is your daughter?
She's 9.
So being a college athlete, did you always know you were going to go into dietetics and specifically sports nutrition? Or how did kind of your background influence your career?
Nope, I actually started out with biology and kind of felt like I should do Department of Conservation, which was funny. I think it was more like my dad thought that was a good idea. I had no heart in it. And then got to where, what's funny is they always house you with all your teammates. And so there were 3 of us that were neck and neck for competitive positions. And it was like, oh, you know, what if I start changing what I'm eating? Maybe I'll get quicker and maybe, you know, I'll get coaches' attention. And so I really started adjusting what I was eating. Kind of took 2 different routes. At first, it was good. I felt better. I recovered better. But then I did probably go down what now would be diagnosed as the red S path and probably lost too much weight, lost strength, hence why my rib injury didn't heal the way that it should. And so that's why now I really devoted my career to that, having fell into that category of just being uneducated and taking it a bit too far. Thought that I could just branch off from there and then go into work in nutrition, and then found out no. So I had to go back and get a 2nd degree, and then did my internship and master's at KU, which I'm very thankful for because I have a lot of great colleagues now that came from that time. And I think if it hadn't been for the rocky path that I would have been on, I think I probably wouldn't be as compassionate to people and also more understanding that you can't just jump straight into dietetics. You really do need to have some clinical background, I believe, because that also makes you more aware of the chronic disease management. And, I mean, sports nutrition's energy 101, so you have to understand if they have anything that's altering energy pathways or metabolism, then obviously they're not going to be the best fueled athlete.
Mm-hmm.
back whenever you were an athlete and you saying that you were kind of experimenting with food, did you have any professional help from the team or anyone back then?
No, and I went to a smaller school, so it kind of cracks me up. We would get on the bus and we would have bags that had like sandwich, chips, and soda. And then we would usually go to like Burger King or McDonald's afterwards because you only had so much money. So it's ironic now, especially as I'm a consultant in collegiate, like trying to get them to branch and find some other ideas. So just like many, I just kind of winged it and started like, oh, what if I ate more fruits and vegetables? Or what if I cut this? Luckily, fad diets weren't as strong because we didn't have as much internet. I'm really aging myself right now. So you just kind of explored with what you had, and like, oh, this made me feel better. Oh, this didn't work so well. But no, obviously I didn't have any professional guidance.
Yeah. So it's almost like you started intuitive eating as an athlete before you even started your career or even knew what you were doing. So, you know, how do you think that influenced, like, did you know that you were intuitive eating or was it not till later and then looking back?
Not till later and looking back, and I think it came when I hit that crossroad of realizing what I was doing was not impacting performance positively, when all of a sudden I was losing strength. I often joke that, you know, one of the markers our coach wanted us to do was be able to bench press our own weight. So I could do that, but then when I got on the court, I was tossed around like a rag doll. I lost my strength. I lost my agility. Again, that injury wasn't quite healing, and then I wasn't as quick reaction time, and so it's like, wait, this isn't actually improving performance. You know, my sweet mate now is ahead of me on the starting lineup. She's getting more time. I felt like an emotional wreck. So from there, I just started kind of like, all right, I need to focus on other things, let my body fall where it needed to be, went back to some of those things that we were supposed to do, like for performance testing, and saw things were actually improving. And I think that's one of the biggest key things with intuitive eating is making sure what you're doing is actually changing performance outcomes other than weight or body fat percentage.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to get into that of like these tips that you use for athletes. But so once you became a dietitian, when was it that you started practicing personally, but more professionally, when did you start practicing intuitive eating? How did that come about?
Oh, you know, honestly, it started in the clinical setting. So I always wanted to get into sports nutrition, but anybody that's out there knows it's hard to get your foot in the door if you don't go straight from like in a collegiate setting. And I taught a cardiac rehab class. And so I would always be like, don't eat this, don't eat that. You need to have strict rules. And then everybody hated to come to my classes. And it dawned on me like, well, that's not a very good way to teach, to be told what you can't have. Let's talk about what we can. And then how are you feeling from that? Because then they would go and they would do their exercise classes and immediately like saw complete changes in their demeanor, what they were coming back, what they were willing to change. And then also the hospital was starting a weight management program and flipped that philosophy to even individuals there, like getting to the root of the why and what kinds of things their body was adjusting when they were trying to lose weight. And that actually led me to then lead the hospital setting, join an eating disorder clinic where I did supervision for over 3 years, and then just really took that philosophy into everything from then on. Athletes, chronic disease, even when somebody comes in for weight management, trying to get them into that non-diet intuitive eating approach, and it's paid off. Because then you believe what you're instilling in them and you don't feel like you're selling something.
Explain to our listeners, because I know this was kind of new to me when I started to speak with more intuitive eating dietitians, but what is supervision when it comes to like the eating disorder clinics? What, tell us more about that.
So especially for therapists, for them to be able to see clients, they have to go through clinical supervision. So what you do is you take your caseload. And I was blessed to work with somebody who was really kind of a pioneer. She's been in the field for over 30 years treating eating disorders. And you blend that therapeutic approach with what we know as MNT. And then you're just kind of that sounding board with somebody that's had experience to kind of say like, hey, let's try this. In my experience, this works best. And then we also have like group supervision. So from there, I've used numerous types. I've done a clinical sports psychology group to help me with working with athletes and eating disorders. The like EDRD Pro, I like how they now have like round table discussions with others. I think that collaboration always makes us better clinicians.
Yeah. And so with intuitive eating in particular, you know, it's not supposed to be about like numbers and it's harder to track. So, and you mentioned this a little bit of like tracking your performance. What are other ways in like all of these different populations and settings, how are these people like tracking their success?
I mean, some of it you can do number driven. So if they especially are going for time, like with runners, I use a lot of what's called rate of perceived exertion. So they have a scale of 1 to 10. Some scales are a little different. And then they tell me like for them to manage their pace, how hard did they feel like they're working? Because usually if they're under fueling, they have to work that much harder. Or if they're under resting too, to get the same pace time. If it's team sports, it may be like, how do they feel like they're recovering? Is it taking longer to recover from workouts? Do they feel like their head stays in the game? So just like we would in class, if they're not fueling appropriately, they'll kind of fog out. They're not exactly remembering what coach is saying, or their ability to grasp concepts will be reduced. So we talk about strategies like that. And then just overall, how do they feel their mood is? Because then they got to turn around and go to the classroom and also study and learn. Is this all tying in that they feel fuels them appropriately so that they can fuel their life, is the saying I use a lot.
Mm-hmm. I love those indicators because it just goes to show, especially as an athlete, I mean, what you eat, all those factors that it impacts, like your mental, because they have so much more demand, you know, not just physically, but also mentally, like you said, in the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what would you say are some of the biggest obstacles for eating intuitively as an athlete?
Oh, so in with especially the college and even the high school kids is time. They are so going from like point A to point B that a lot of times they don't have that time to connect with their body and go, what's going on today? And for some, they may be sitting down to training meals where they don't get a whole lot of options. They're there by whatever is selected for them. Or they may be like, I only get this chance to have one big meal, so this is what I have to do. And it really disconnects them from those intuitive eating skills. So I try to at least have them, I say, do once an hour or once every other hour, 1 minute check-ins, deep breaths, scan from head to toe. Do you need to go empty your bladder? I mean, sometimes it's as simple as that, that connects them back to their body. Are you taking nice, big, deep breaths that go all the way through the bottom of your abdomen and out? Can you wiggle your toes? And that starts them get those sensations in their body. And then they can be aware like, oh my gosh, you know, I just now realized I'm starving. I've been ignoring it for 2 hours. I probably should have had a snack. Or, you know, I'm noticing my sleep disrupted. Well, let's start to look. Are you restricting carbohydrates? Are you not doing enough decompressing before bed? Let's kind of reconnect with that.
I think that 1 minute check-in is a great tip for anyone. I mean, so many of us are going a mile a minute, whether we're an athlete or like, you know, working a 9-to-5 or a mom. Like a lot of us are suppressing like how we feel. So I think doing those 1 minute check-ins would be really powerful for a lot of different people.
Absolutely. I often joke, like when I worked around nurses and they would come back and like, oh, I need to pee. And I'm like, didn't you tell me that 2 hours ago when I saw you on the floor? And I'd be like, you know, those body signals are there for a reason. We don't want them to not be there anymore.
Yeah.
Same thing with hunger, fullness.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I feel like that is such a foundation of intuitive eating, is that mindfulness piece of, you know, before you can even act or do anything or, you know, bring about change, we have to just be aware, right? And like, that is such a simple tip. I love that.
And I just wrote a blog like about how if we only treat ourselves and others as we treat our pets, that really our body has this beautiful built-in wisdom. We just have to not try to interpret it and just let it tell you what it needs. And you'll be surprised how far that will take you in health and performance.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say you have this athlete who has never practiced intuitive eating. Maybe you find that they are, you know, not quite to the point of an eating disorder, but like they are so far out of touch with their body. What would be kind of your first steps from a counseling standpoint, like how would you even begin, and how long would that take to get someone kind of where you would want them to be?
So sometimes it's fun at, especially the evening meal, that may be the best one that they can actually take their time with. And so I have them do a couple bites, take a deep breath, and it's almost being, especially if you can do it in session, that's powerful. But if not, then you have them kind of journal and describe what that feels like before the meal, what actually sounds good, what do they feel like their body's needing. So that's where you tie into, you do need a little bit of structure, like what training, what's going on, because sometimes like intense training actually disconnects you from hunger signals. But then for females, what we find is then it comes on really strong. So giving them that education basics, then telling them to go from there and what does that feel like at the meal? When do they start to feel full? Do they feel like energy is coming back, and kind of tying that in? Because many times they have been so rushed from day one that they have no eating foundation. They're not competent eaters because they were never given the opportunity to. So you're starting from scratch.
So we're talking about, you know, how they're eating, but what do you recommend them eating? Because I think with a lot of athletes, you know, they're counting their macros or something else. But with intuitive eating, are you following a framework like that? Or what are you recommending to them?
Well, I think it is important. I mean, intuitive eating, I think a lot of people feel like it's just free willy, like you're just going out there. But you still, I often use, like, you still have suggested speed limits, right? So that you make sure that you get the foundation. And so I always talk about identifying what is their carb. Now, maybe depending on training, their body might be saying that they want more of that. What's their protein? What's their fat? And then also doing what sounds appealing is that they don't have to get so caught up in that all the food has to be perfect. You know, all fuel can fit in. I love this last Winter Olympics, like all the stories of athletes that were talking about how they had grandma's chocolate chip cookies for their afternoon snack or chocolate mousse, you know, after they race, that you can incorporate that in. But obviously, just like you're building a training program, you still have to build your nutrition as well.
Yeah, I like that. I love the speed limit thing. That's fun. I like that. Because, I mean, when I think about an athlete, it's like, yeah, you do need, like, carbs to perform. And so it's just interesting to think about that. How can you meet those recommendations but still have a healthy mindset behind it and not treat it black and white?
Right. And part of what I love how the U.S. OC came up with athlete my plate. So they took that my plate that we switched the food guide from. But I think especially we've gotten so caught up in nutrients or macros that we forget what it's like to have a presentation on a plate. So I say, like, what sounds good? Like, what would go with your oatmeal that would complement it? What would you expect at Panera? How would they present that? And so it helps them start thinking, like, intuitive cooking. There's a great TED Talk that talks about how we've lost our intuition in the kitchen. And so that really blends both of those together.
I love that, too, because, I mean, we know that if we are truly listening to our bodies, I think especially as an athlete, they know if they're omitting carbohydrates, they're going to feel that, right? So
right,
it's like it goes hand in hand. But, I mean, it definitely sounds like it takes practice, but they knowing that they should incorporate all food groups, it'll make them feel better.
And as a dietitian, the good thing is that we understand what those nutrients are needed for. So I can remember I had a male athlete that was really trying to go low carb. He had his mindset on getting to a particular body fat. And I said, how's your sleep? Well, you know what? I'm not sleeping at all anymore. I said, okay, humor me and just try a scoop of rice at dinner tonight. And do that. And then he comes back. He's like, oh my God, I'm sleeping so much better. I was like, yeah, carbs produce serotonin and melatonin. You have to have that. And so just providing that education, then he was able to understand that that meant also sleep, rest, recovery.
I'm sure that's really powerful for an athlete. Like, I can either be 2 percentage points lower in my body fat, or I can get a great night's sleep. Like, I don't know. I would definitely choose the sleep.
What's going to affect my
body? So would my family members.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. Sleep, then your attitude the next day. And like.
Okay. Well, and there's I really like Riley Nichols. He's a sports psychologist that's the head of Victory Program. And he even had on the presentation, like, 100 different factors outside of weight that affect performance. And I love to pull that out and be like, okay, which ones do you think you could work on? Oh, looky here. And then there's weight. So let's maybe focus on these outside of it, which is more controllable.
Mm-hmm. Working in bariatrics, I always tell my patients too, like when we're setting goals into sessions, like you cannot affect that number. Like you can literally not change that number. Right. So like, what's the point in focusing on it when you can't like look at it, make it go up or make it go down? That is not a factor that you really have power over. And putting that, I think saying that kind of puts it into perspective for them.
Exactly. And again, so many times I've learned from incorporating intuitive eating, I often joke with my clients that I know when I'm getting ready to get sick. And they're like, how do you know that? I was like, strangely, I will be ravenous, but then I feel like my stomach doesn't empty. And then about 24 hours later comes the fatigue, and sure enough, I'll have a virus. But I listen to it, and so usually my duration is short, and I just find that fascinating. I'm like, yeah, keep looking for things like that. Like, you know, when marathon training, I would never be hungry for about 48 hours, but watch out. Like that one day, and I would crave potato chips. Well, I didn't usually like potato chips, but I think it was needing the carbs, needing the salt. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our bodies are pretty darn cool if we let them be that way.
Yeah. So how can some of these tips that we've talked about for athletes, how can they apply to just a regular exerciser who might not be training as hard?
Sure. So performance is performance. It doesn't have to necessarily be a collegiate athlete or professional athlete. It might be somebody wanting to do their first 5K or 10K, or it might be simply like myself, you know, I want to be in good shape, but I also need to be a busy mom running a business. So performance is me. I need to be able to stay focused when I'm with clients. I need to be able to remember that my daughter needs to be at practice at 6:30 a.m. and that I need to go to this appointment. And so, again, taking that time to decompress, connect with your body, ask what challenges might be coming up, like if it's a really crazy, hectic day and that you're probably going to be eating lunch within 5 minutes, how can you still be present in that meal? And then what's going to be needed nutritionally, like when you're grocery shopping or if you're going out and grabbing lunch, what you're still going to need. But then you stop and say, like, what sounds good to me right now? You know, what is going to bring me pleasure and what's also going to bring me nourishment, because you can't have nourishment without having pleasure. And I think so many people have lost that.
Yeah, that's a great point. And how do you personally do your grocery shopping as far as whenever you go grocery shopping in the beginning of the week or whenever you do it, do you think like, oh, what sounds really good this week? Or do you, because I've been seeing some of this stuff on social media about like, you know, planning out your meals for the week, but also finding stuff that sounds good on a whim.
So I do a blend of both. I'm blessed that I grew up in the country, and so my parents still have a farm, so I have fresh eggs and whatever is in the garden and beef and things like that. So sometimes that helps me rotate what's going to be the main protein. And then I tie in being realistic. If it needs to be a crock pot meal that I can start in the morning and it's home when I get done, then what crock pot meals sound good? Or, you know, are we going to have leftovers so that on my late night, I don't expect my husband to cook? It's a little too stressful for him to do that and get my daughter. But, you know, looking, if it's really hot, sometimes a nice BLT sounds good. Or if it's cold, you know, a nice good chili. So I do try to incorporate that in. And sometimes I'll switch around what we have planned if I'm in the mood for something else. But most of the time, it's usually dishes that sound appealing to all of us. And also asking my daughter and my husband too, like, hey, guys, got anything that you've been craving or wanting this week, because I want my daughter to learn that that's important to connect with their body and try to do what sounds appealing and is nourishing.
Sorry, that
was a long answer.
No, I love that. I think that's helpful. That's helpful for people when they think about, you know, not getting caught up in this quote unquote meal prep.
Oh, I find most people by the third day are so sick of what they prepped. And I know I can usually do leftovers for 2 days, but that third day I'm like, whoa, give me something different to eat. I can't do it anymore.
I so agree. I would rather eat the exact same thing leftover like for 3 meals in a row than have it for like one meal for like 6 days. Like I'm over it after, like you said, like 2 days, I'm over it.
sometimes for me, it's like whatever sounds nourishing, but also is easy. Like easy sometimes trumps in my head.
Oh, yeah.
So like we have turkey wraps. Like we'll have that for like 2 weeks for lunch, you know, for because it's easy and quick to pack to work. And then until the point where we both go, okay, we want something else. And so we kind of eat in like cycles. I know that's weird for most people, but it varies.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you. Sometimes we're the beast of necessity. Who's got time? I wish I had time to prepare 3 hot meals a day, but it ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. We love to ask this of those that we interview. So tell us, what is the best thing that has happened to you this week?
Well, gosh, since it's early in the week, I'm hoping there's lots more, but it's been fun. My daughter has always begged to be able to go to work with me, but in a counseling type of an area, you can't. Well, I'm also a consultant in a university for the athletic department. So they have a basketball camp that's finally for kids. So it was really fun, like taking her, dropping her off at camp, and then I go work with the athletes, and then she gets to meet some of the athletes that I work with. So that's been fun. So I finally got to take my daughter to work day.
Oh, that is awesome. And she also like got to do her own thing. It wasn't like
exactly.
And she got to meet the athletes. Yeah. She probably thought like, I have the coolest mom ever.
Oh, I don't know about that, but usually she's like, Mom, drop me off and leave.
I don't want anyone to know you work here.
Yeah.
That's the stage of motherhood that I'm not looking forward to with having girls, is like the inevitable, I'm not as interested in you as I am.
At least it's not boys yet.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's been so great to chat. How can our listeners find you on social media or wherever?
Yeah, so you can go to my website, which is www.beccamcconville. And I'm sure we have a link to spell that out for him.
Yep.
Okay. And then Instagram is Rebecca ED Dietitian. And you can find me on Facebook, Fit for a Queen Podcast. I'm kind of like all over. But you can sign up for a newsletter that also has little tidbits. And I try to keep up with I'll be sure to put your guys' podcast on there. I call it Bits, Blogs, and Books. And it's things that are out there that have good information for people to follow. So they can sign up for that each month.
Excellent.
Love that. Lots of places. So feel free to reach out to Becca if you have questions or, you know, want to work with her if you are an athlete, or maybe you just, you know, really found this episode interesting. Check out her podcast, Fit for a Queen, PHIT for a Queen. Yeah.
Well, thanks, guys.
Bye, Becca. Thanks again. Thanks for listening to this episode of Fit Friends Happy Hour. If you liked this episode, don't forget to share it with a friend. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook at Fit Friends Happy Hour. Talk to you next time.